Nu er det min kæmpe store fornøjelse at få lov til at introducere vores åbningsspeaker. Det er Alan, som er kommet hele vejen fra Needles, California. Så lad os give en kæmpe hånd.
But if there's one thing I've learned around here is that when Ellen's train jumps her track, it gets on God's track, I'll be okay. And I'll feel when that happens and you'll hear it. But until then, we're just gonna shake together. Got my shoes off. Christian said it's a family show, so I'll have to keep the clothes on, but you know, maybe I'll take this off a little bit. So I am so excited to be here. I want to thank the God of my understanding. You know, I know for me that the search of a God of my understanding is one of the most difficult and one of the most challenging and important endeavors that I ever took on in my life. And what I was looking for was a connection to a higher power, a connection to other people, but more than that, what I was looking for was a connection to myself. And I did not know this. I did not know any of that. I grew up broken. I grew up with no self-esteem. I grew up in an abusive household. The first 5 years of my life, it was like a fairy tale. So the last thing I wanted to do was be an addict. So as I stand before you, I want to thank the committee for believing in me and choosing me and flying me here to stand before you and share what they think is my experience, strength, and hope. I'm so honored. I'm so utterly honored. I have been welcomed with love, with hospitality, just unbelievable an experience running all over on ferry boats and trains and getting on the wrong train. Oh my God, we met some drunk people yesterday. Oh my goodness, these young boys were so drunk and they all loved me. I guess I look like a mama, you know, and I'm all fluffy. I am a mother, I'm a grandmother, I am a great-grandmother. So, I've been around a while, a little bit. I'm married, I have 9 children, 6 of my own and 3 others. My youngest daughter is she started out as a foster child and she has been my baby for 20 years, so she's 21 years old now. And so I have a big family, and my family is kind of different and crazy. We could have our own television show. We were on the train yesterday, and this man says, I'll start with this. I'll cut the ice with this. He wants to know where we met. And she says, oh, we met online. He says, oh, Facebook? And she says, just online. That's all you need to know. So he looks at her. He looks and says, oh, so you were hooking up? And I went, oh my God, no. No, no, no. So we didn't meet online like that. We met in a place called In the Rooms, which is a Narcotics Anonymous chat room, and I'm actually here to speak at a convention. And she says, I would have told him that I didn't want to break your anonymity. I said, Jesus Christ, so you want to make him think we're sleeping together? So we had so much fun. It was really, really great. So I'm attracted to shiny things. I bet some of you are too. You like shiny things? You gotta be careful. And I collect key tags. I collect key tags. You can collect key tags too. I can speak someday. So I have every single key tag that I've ever been given. So I've collected a few. These are my key tags. Not in English. It says in Danish, it says that I'm clean and clear sighted. I thought, well, I'm not sure that's true, but but it says so right here. I'm gonna believe it. Clear and clear sighted for decades. I celebrated 26 years this month. One day at a time. I'm an addict. I suffer from the disease of addiction. That's what Narcotics Anonymous is. A lot of people get in here nervous, it's all about drugs, or what drug, or this drug, or that drug. It's not about drugs at all. We're not here because of drugs. We're here because we suffer from the disease of addiction. And when that hole opens up in my stomach, and my guts are on the floor, and I'm bleeding out, and I'm trying to close that hole, and I'm trying to fill it, I'm going to say that, okay, wait, disclaimer. Everything I'm going to talk about is Ellen's opinion, Ellen's experience, Ellen's thoughts, and none of them is WSO approved. So just I want you to know that. So, and I try not to swear. I really try, but I will say the F word one time. Thank you. So in filling this hole in my stomach that I want to fill, I'm out here, I'm looking out here. I can promise you, if I can see it, feel it, taste it, touch it, fuck it, buy it, or try to fix it, there is not enough of it to fill this hole inside of me. It doesn't matter. It's not about drugs. You can never do drugs again, and you can live, you can be clean and live dirty. So you can be cheating on your spouse, you can be spending money you don't have, you can be gambling, you can overeat, you can go, you think because you go to work all day long, 7 days a week, and you pay the bills, but you don't participate in life, do you think you're in recovery? I don't think I'm in recovery if I'm acting like that. And I work in a field where that's possible. You know, you're just working all day, all night, all day, 7 days a week, trying to get things ready. So, you know, I'm kind of like slipped back out of that a little bit for lots of reasons, and my husband's in that profession, and he still does it. So he works all the time. And we're both in recovery. I will tell you that the man I'm married today to, I did not agree to marry. I did not agree to marry the man that shares my home. We were not clean when we got married. We were married 9 years and had 5 children when I got clean. And it all started with my husband telling my husband had, back up. My connection got busted. My connection was court ordered to NA meetings. I went to my first NA meeting loaded out of my mind. Oh my God. And you know what, and I didn't pray anymore. I'm a Catholic girl, went to Catholic school all my life, thought I wanted to be a nun, prepared for that for a long time. Yeah, right. And see how that worked out. So I, my bottom, and we all have different bottoms. You know, the elevator comes down for all of us, all the way down. You can get off at any floor you want. You don't have to ride that elevator to the ground, to the basement. That's the morgue. That's where they put the toe tags on us. We can get off that elevator anytime you want. I will suggest women's lingerie, remote control cars, battery operated toys, kitchenware, anywhere. But just, you know what, get off the elevator. When the door's open, get the hell out. Get out and take the steps back up. Because we don't get to ride the elevator back up. We do have to take steps. We do have to work steps and get back up. And there's no free ride. There's nothing handed to us. You know, this program is freely given to us by our predecessors, people who have worked the program, those people. And if you come before me, I thank you. If you come after me, I thank you. If you are of service, I thank you. If you hug newcomers, I thank you. If you make coffee, I thank you. If you show up to meetings and share your experience, strength, and hope, and put your truth on the table so another addict need not die from the horrors of addiction, I thank you. Because we've all been there. There's nothing you have done that someone else hasn't done. You know, it's just not going to happen. You know, I thought the worst thing that could ever happen in life is that someone would find out that I was sexually abused. I thought I could never tell that secret. And when I was in treatment, an H&I panel came into this program, which was not Narcotics Anonymous based, and they got up there. And these men talked about being sexually abused, and I almost hit the floor. My God, don't we take that to our graves? We don't talk about that. And I thought about that first meeting, that very first meeting I went into with my friend, my connection, who became a client. And we went to that meeting, and I did not pray to God because I had had an abortion, and I now deserved to die. I had judged myself. I had been found guilty, and the sentence was death. And I had just spent 3 months trying to kill myself, and, you know, not, and I couldn't kill myself because I couldn't give my soul to God. So it was really a very, very dark place that I was in. And so we go into this meeting, and what do? They turn the flipping lights out, light candles, and call God into the room. And I'm just going, oh, my. I was almost under the table. I sat there white-knuckling it. And I didn't think anyone knew we were loaded. You've seen people come in, see girls coming into a meeting loaded. Their eyes are spinning this way, they're spinning this way, they can't sit, can't stand, don't make sense. You know, walking around in circles, shaking, looking for the door. And what do? We tell them, let us love you until you learn to love yourself. That does not mean let me screw you until you learn to masturbate. I know people like sex, you know, all we all do. And we're a bunch of sick people around here. But, you know, when it comes to bringing a newcomer in and teaching them that we can chew you up, spit you out, and walk on you just like it happened out there inside these rooms, there's nowhere left for them to go. So they need to have a little bit of a break. You know, so that's why they suggest the women stick with women and the men stick with men. That is the reason. We come here with no boundaries. We don't know what love is. We think it's sex, or we think it's what something happened or what someone did to us, or we think that that's love because, you know, they said they loved us when they did that to us. You know, we're so confused. You know, I have a man that I sponsored for years. I have a gay man who I sponsored for years that after working the steps realized that he wasn't gay. He'd been procured as a young boy into prostitution by his person who gave him drugs, been pimped out, and never had an experience with a female in his life. So he didn't know any different, and he later on got married and had family. That, you know, that's the only time I've ever heard of something like that, but it just happened. And it was really interesting to me. It was just very, very interesting. So I do have two gentlemen that I sponsor, and then when my friend Mike asked me to sponsor him, I said, are you gay? He said, why do you want me for a sponsor? Because you really should have a man, because I don't know how to be a man. I know how to be a woman. And I know how to be a lady today. And he said, you're loving, you're kind. You show unconditional love to everyone. And I want to be like you. So I said, so you want to find your feminine side. Okay, we can work together for a little bit, but you got to find a man. So, you know, we all sponsor each other in this program. I don't care if you've got one day, if you got 1 week, if you've got 26 years, you got 40 years, we do for each other. We are all here to be good examples. Some of us to be good examples, and some of us to be good bad examples. Which one do you want to be? My nana used to tell me, Ellen Ann, pretty is as pretty does. So, you know, it's like when we're talking out the side of our neck, you know, everyone's watching what we're doing. The world judges us. We judge ourselves by our intentions, but the world judges us by our actions. And actions speak way louder than words. So when my husband came to me and said, I hear from a very good source that you're about to take a really big fall. And I looked at him and I said, who told you that your friend, the judge, the one you drink with every night? And so he said, Ellen, I love you more than anything, and I'll do anything for you. And I wanted to believe that. I did. I didn't believe it at all. The next morning, I went to bed that night, and I was, my heart was pounding, and, you know, I got loaded because I wanted to get him sober. And I knew I couldn't drink. I'm allergic to alcohol. I break out in nakedness and in bed with men I'm not married to. It's a true story. It's true. You know, my husband died when I was 27 years old. His friend asked me out to lunch. I went out to lunch with him. We went out to dinner. My aunt died. You know, I don't handle death very well. Got drunk. I kind of remember getting in the car to drive from Los Angeles to Palos Verdes. It's like a 50-minute drive on the freeway. And I wake up in the morning, and I'm laying there, and I could tell I'm naked. And I'm just going, oh, God, I'm naked. My head hurts. I'm going to throw up. And I open my eyes, and there's vaulted ceilings, crown molding, chandelier. I'm like, oh, French windows, lace curtains. I don't have a bedroom like this. Where the hell am I? You know, and I feel the cover, and there's an eiderdown on the bed, but it's not mine because I have a satin duvet. So this is not my bedroom, and this is not my bed. And I'm thinking, oh my God, and I'm dying. I'm going to throw up any second. And I turned my head, and I went, oh, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, that is not my husband. And I knew this because my husband had just died just a month before, and I was a hot mess. So I'm trying to get out of the bed, and I'm grabbing the sheet, and I'm trying to cover myself up, and I thought, oh, you saw plenty last night, floozy. And so I'm getting out of the bedroom, and I'm trying to get to the bathroom before I throw, and I'll tell you, as I did that walk of shame to the bathroom, it hurt to swallow, it hurt to walk, and I was thanking God my butt didn't hurt, because at least I didn't do that. Because I had no recollection of what I had done the night before, but I knew what I had been doing all night long. All night, obviously. So I'm in the bathroom, puking, crying, thinking of a way to kill myself. Could I break the mirror, slit my wrist? What do I do? But my daughter's here, my four-year-old's out there. And then I go looking for my daughter, and she's not there. So now I have to go in and wake Prince Alarming up. Where's my daughter? Oh, your dad has her not. Oh, Jesus, what did my daddy say? He says, I think he used the word floozy. Well, in Ireland, floozy means slut. I went, oh, God. I said, I gotta go. He says, where are you going? I said, I gotta go home. I gotta get my daughter. I gotta see my father. I gotta face my father. I need to find out about my aunt's funeral. He said, well, what are you doing next weekend? I said, I don't know why. He says, well, I'm really sorry about last night. I thought maybe we could go to dinner next weekend. And I looked at him and I, you want to see me again? He said, see you, I'm going to marry you. And I went, oh, Jesus, and I ran. So he called me all week long, and my dad's going, he called you. And I'm like, look, I already slept with him. I don't want to call him back. I'm not calling him. So finally I did. I went out to dinner with him, and yeah, we've been married, you know, 35 years. So I didn't know he was alcoholic. I didn't know. He'd been my friend for 11 years. He was my husband's friend, but he was an alcoholic, and at some point I decided he had to change. You need to stop drinking because you have a problem. And so I just told you what happens when I drink, so I can't drink. So I thought, well, if I do some cocaine, I can go drink some alcohol, and then I can get him sober. And then, well, you know, to hell in a handbasket. We could just fast forward it. I was in the largest drug bust in the tri-state history. News at 11. It was horrible. My daughter tried to kill herself 2 days later. She spent a month in a mental institution in Los Angeles. She was 12. And I blamed everyone but her mother. And then my husband, when he finally, you know, does this intervention on me, that next morning after he'd said that, he woke me up for the first time in a long time and said, Ellen, I love you more than anything in the world, and I'll do anything for you. I thought, yeah. So he left. I borrowed a car, and I drove to Palm Springs, and I said the first prayer that I had said since February 24th, the day of my abortion. And I said, if you're there, if you can hear my voice, if you see anything in me worth saving, I am begging you to save my life now. I had nothing to lose. This is toe tag time. So he's gonna help me or he's gonna take my kids away and then I'm gonna kill myself. So I get down there and I knock on his door and he's shocked and we sit down and I said, I gotta tell you a few things. You're right, I'm doing drugs. He says, where are you getting this stuff? I said, in Mojave Valley. He said, in Arizona. I said, yeah, Arizona. He said, Arizona, like in Arizona. You bring it into California. I said, yeah. He says, interstate trafficking of drugs, felony, 15 to 20 years in prison. I said, I'm not a felon, I'm president of Seroptimus, for God's sake. He's looking at me like, he said, how are you paying for it? That's what really scared him. How are you paying for it? Because he pays the bills. I said, it's simple. My friend gave me a great deal so I wouldn't deal with some weirdos that he says are really bad people. And so I just go get her money and I give it to him and he gives it to me for like nothing. It's like really almost, I don't even know why he's charging me. And then she gives me part of it and then we're all happy. He says, that's facilitation. You're a drug dealer. I said, no, I'm not. I coach the needle swim team. What are you talking about? I'm president of the PGA. like, oh my God. And he said, where do you keep your drugs? I said, in my safe. He said, oh my God, you have a safe? I said, yes, I have a safe. I said, don't worry, I'm under control. If there's 30 days in the month, I got 30 bindles marked 1 through 30. And if there's 31, I've got 1 through 31. He said, possession of drugs for sale. You are a felon. I said, for God's sake, they're not for sale. He said, you don't get it. Oh, I forgot to tell you. My husband is a criminal defense attorney. And he's looking at his criminal wife just, I mean, my God. The man's hair is pure white. I did not do that. He went gray young. Poor Brian. Poor Brian. Oh, my God. He said, don't worry, honey. We'll find you a good place. So I said, I got to go. And he's trying to keep me there. Because you're doing an intervention on someone. You want to hold on to him. You don't want to let go. And I said, I got to go. But you all know what I had to do. Well, let me tell you. I went home, and I returned that car to my friend. And I did more drugs that night than I had done in 3 months, and I did not get high. And that was God doing for me what I could not do for myself. The next day, as a joke, I called Camp Betty. And as a joke, they said, we'll see you tomorrow. I said, oh my God, this is really happening? So my husband calls and says, we're going to find you a nice place, sweetheart. And I said, oh, don't worry. I called the Betty Ford Center. They're going to take me tomorrow morning. He said, you're kidding me. He said, that fast? I said, yeah, I've never gotten anyone into treatment that fast. He said, I'll be right home. I said, you just got there. He said, I'm coming home. So he comes home, and I got all this stuff in the safe, and I can't throw it away. So for the first time in my life, I sold drugs. I called all my friends and said, hey, I got to go. I got a business sale here. Let's get rid of this shit. I got to go. I can't believe any drugs. But I need some money to take my kids to Disneyland when I get back. And I don't want to ask my husband for money. I can't even believe I did this. I just can't even believe that I was that person. So that's what my husband comes home. He's like, isn't that my client? I'm going, oh, they're just coming to say goodbye. What was he doing here? Oh, just coming to say goodbye. My poor husband. Oh, my God. So I got rid of all the good stuff and went to treatment. And we're driving down there. And I looked at him. My daddy used to say, Ellen, if it looks like a duck, it acts like a duck, and hangs around with ducks, it's a duck. So we're driving down, I looked at him, and I said, I guess I'm a duck, huh? He said, yeah. Now you can look, see the Ellen Ann Campbell Needle, National Highway from Needles, California to Palm Springs. You can see my fingernail marks all the way down the road to Palm Springs. We'll come up and say, what do you have to do this for? Please, God damn it, take me home. He's going, Ellen, please go to sleep. I said, I'll go to meetings. I'll do what you have to do. I'll go to church. I won't say the F word. I wear dresses all the time. Whatever you want. Just tell me what you want. Just don't make me do this. He said, please, for God's sake, I've had no sleep. Go to sleep. So he took me, and then we get out of the car, and 50 ducks come running across the lawn. I went, whoa, my family, I guess I'm home. And he drove away and left me there. Left me. Go figure. I could not believe he did that. What kind of a husband does that shit? It was so scary. I was in a fog the first week and very afraid. And I had to write down, and they talked about steps and traditions, and I'm thinking about traditions. Christmas, Thanksgiving, presents, or birthdays, or what is this shit? And the steps, going up the stairs, I gotta exercise, what is this? Stair stepper? You know, and slowly, slowly, slowly. I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad was 21 years sober when he died. But I really didn't pay attention. They just had nice donuts. I used to say, Ellen Ann, there's a chair waiting here for you. And I, oh my God, I'm always welcome. I said, Ellen Ann, you have an addictive personality. I thought, oh, people meet me and they're addicted. How sweet. How sweet. You know, self-centeredness is the core of our disease. It's the very core of our disease. We resent the past, we're angry at the present, and we're so fearful of the future. You know, and there's a little IP called Triangle of Self-Obsession that explains all of that. And it's really, really difficult to get out of that, you know, going around in that circle and all those, you know, we believe these little truths, these lies or these falsehoods, or you know, we have the mind of a child as we're coming up, and we internalize all this stuff, and we build this foundation on quicksand, and we don't understand why we're sinking and why we're drowning right there in our own very feet. And I had to learn that when I did this, the world did not just take a revolution. You know, for me it did. So I had to write out all the ways that I tried to control my using, and I just told you. I told you just now all the ways I tried to control my using. You know, I was only going to use this much, I'm going to use on these days, I was only used to get him sober, then I was only used to work, then I'm going to keep this much, I'm going to market, well, I'm going to only use this much, but if you shared with me, or you shared with me, we could do your shit. Well, I could still do mine. Well, I wasn't going to share mine. Very selfish. So I had to look at that on a piece of paper. I will tell you that everything looks different on paper than it does in here. I've been to a lot of dangerous neighborhoods in my life. A lot of dangerous neighborhoods. But the most dangerous neighborhood I have ever been to is the one between these ears. Because people die in here, and I am one of them. I will die in here. And everything looks really pretty in here because I have really pretty boxes that looks like God designed them and ribbons that the angels spin. And I put it in a little box, and it looks so lovely. And if I thought of it, it's a really great idea, and if you thought of it, it sucks, period. No discussion. We don't even have to talk about it. So, you know, I had to learn a lot. I mean, I came in here, you know, being octo mom. I was the oldest of 8 kids. I have my own kids, and everything was crazy. I didn't know which way was up or down, or all these things that I thought about myself. I didn't know what I thought about myself. I didn't know who the hell I was. I will tell you, if I had committed suicide in the first 5 years of my recovery, I would have committed murder because I did not know who I was. And so I would have killed someone that I never even had a chance to meet or get to know or love or appreciate or allow to have hope or a future. So after I wrote out all those ways, and I had to write down all the dangerous and illegal situations I got myself into. Now that's all. Oh my God. Man, I remember getting high. Princess here has a lighter that's not a Bic. It's pretty. It has a flint and lighter fluid. So when you take the cap off and light it, you have to blow it out. You can't throw it on the bed after you light your torch. So I set my bed on fire while I was sitting in it. And I'm getting high, talking on the phone to a friend. Next thing I know, my bed's on fire. Thank God I didn't leave the house that night. I would have killed my whole family. My husband was out of town at work, as usual, and the children were asleep. You know, their nanny was asleep, and I would have walked out that house like any other night I usually did, and my whole house would have burned down that night, and my whole family would have died. And I know that today. I picked a friend up from jail one night, and we were going to move from my connect, the one that went to jail, and the one that needed the lawyer back then. And so we're going to go to my house, and I thought, I can't go with this dope, so I decided to stash the dope. Well, guys, you don't have a place like this, so you couldn't have done it. But I did it. I got pulled over by the police, too. And this police officer didn't know me, and I had a packet on the floor with my pipe and my torch and my name engraved on the torch. Who does that? Who does that? Holy God. Jesus, Mary and Joseph. So after he questions me, he lets me go, and I go home, and I find out years later that the reason I got let go was this person was a rookie in training, and he got in a lot of trouble for letting me go because the man who was in charge knew I was loaded out of my mind. I asked Mark, why did you let me go that night? And they explained it to me. And so I got home, and I couldn't get the dope out. Who do you call, Ghostbusters? Excuse me, my dope is lost up in... it took me a while. I finally got it out, but I couldn't call my husband. I couldn't call my husband. He didn't know I got high. There wasn't really anyone I wanted fishing around getting my dope out of there, and I didn't know what to do. So these are the, you know... I didn't think I was insane, but my behavior was insane. I had to look at my life and look at where all the unmanageability was. You know, so I looked at all the unmanageability and where it manifested in my social life, in my religious life, in my work life. You know, I had all this unmanageability all over the place. And they made me look at it. And looking at it on paper was a lot different than what it looks like inside my head in that beautiful package. So I was kind of shocked when I thought, God, whose life is this? It's not my beautiful life. So, you know, denial is not a river in Egypt, but it is a river that runs through my veins, through my body. And I can jump in that river with my eyes wide shut, my eyes wide open. My disease speaks to me in my voice. My disease tells me that I don't have a disease, and I believe everything it says. So I had to learn a whole new way of living. And so I go, so after I do this, and then the hardest part of that exercise for me was, where do you want to see yourself in 1 year? And I thought, where do I want to see myself in 1 year? I can't even think about tomorrow. How can I think about 1 year from now? How can I think about a month from now? And I thought, it was May. I thought, May. Next May, it's going to be getting hot. It'll be about 115 degrees where I live. Gets to be 128 where I live. I think it's like 55 for you. 55? I don't know your math, sorry. We're the only country that doesn't do that. We're so stupid. I'm sorry. I'm American. What do you expect? Just chalk it up to being an American. Don't hold that against me. So I thought, I can't do that. But when was I ever happy? When was I ever happy? Did I ever have happiness? And I tried to think back, because at that point, our literature talks about being reduced to the animal level and being disconnected from emotion, human emotion, and that's where I was. When I went to that first meeting, Loaded, John was having his second birthday, and they were all talking about how proud they were of him, how much they loved each other, how far he had come, and talked about all these different things, and I didn't have those feelings. I had 5 children and a husband, and sisters and brothers, and I didn't have those feelings anymore. I was like numb. I was like dead. It was the zombie apocalypse right here. And I tried to think, and I thought, Christmas is a good time. My children love Christmas. I used to love Christmas. Sit up all night long cursing myself for buying all this shit, having to wrap it all up, put all the screws in there, put it all together, get bicycles, have a screw missing, the holes don't line up. Those were the good times. And I thought, maybe next Christmas, 18 months, maybe God would give me another chance. Maybe I could have a baby. Maybe I would be able to have another child. And maybe we could go on. Maybe my husband could forgive me. Maybe I could forgive me. I don't know if God will. I found out God knew what I was going to do before I did it. So that was my thought. That's what I wrote that day. If we write what we think we deserve or where we think we want to be, we shortchange ourselves every single time when you think about the future and the miracles, because this place just rains miracles. And where I was in December of 1994, 18 months later, was 9 months pregnant at Christmas, about to give birth to my last child, Kevin. So I have had a baby in recovery. And life is in session for me. They told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days to get a sponsor, to work the steps with that sponsor, to stick with the women, and not to drink or use, not even if my ass fell off. And if your ass falls off, pick it up, bring it to a meeting, and the nice people in that room will teach you a new way to sit. So I've been doing this over and over again. Those bitches, look where they put my ass. It looks way better back here. I know it does. I look in the mirror and imagine it back here. But I can shave my ass and my face at the same time, or at least keep my teeth from being knocked out. Whatever, life's good today. Life's good. I'm twice the woman my husband married, and the scale says so. That's okay. I was a little sick back then. I was very thin. So I'm healthy now. I'm very healthy. So I did all those things. I came home, and then I became Mother Teresa, the Statue of Liberty. I will save you. I'm going to catch you. Come to NA. And I'm running around trying to catch people with my butterfly net. I'm going to take them to meetings. And come on, we're going to go do this. My husband bought me this van that went beep, 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 beep. When you back up, it had a door that opened like a bus. I'd pack them all up. We drive to Las Vegas, drive to Lake Havasu City, the NA Way Express. Ruthie's mooning people when Ruthie sit down. So we had a lot of fun in the early days. We still had a lot of fun, but we were so young. We were like children, and we didn't even go to the store alone. I was so afraid to go to the store or go anywhere alone. I went with people in recovery. I went to a meeting every single day. I went to 387 meetings in my first 90 days, because you can do that in Los Angeles. And then I came home, and I went to a meeting every single day, and I got service commitments, and I did what they suggested. I did what they were suggested. You don't have to do anything suggested to you. Don't worry about suggestions. They're not important at all. So the next time a police officer says, I suggest you get in that car, you don't have to listen to him. Don't do it. Just a suggestion. Today I listened to suggestions. Today, if you show me that you stuck your hand in the fire and you got burned, I'm going to believe it, that you got burned. I don't have to stick my hand in the fire to find out it got burned. I see people do stupid shit. I don't have to do stupid shit to show you that there's a better way to do your stupid shit. I will do it. So I try to be the best person that I can be. I worked through the steps with my sponsor, and it was very difficult. My fourth step, I wrote down what I thought she wanted me to say or what she wanted to hear. So when I spoke my fifth step and it came out that I was less than truthful, I did a lot more writing. And I had to, took 27 and a half hours for my fifth step. And a lot of crying and a lot of emotion. And what happened in the middle of my fifth step when she realized I wasn't being honest, she said, "I thought you wanted to be a good mother and a good wife." I said, "I am a good mother and a good wife." "But really, who was taking care of your children while you're getting high?" And I said, "Their nanny." She said, "Oh, mother of the year, their nanny, nice." She says, "You think you're a good wife? You think you spread those two legs and that makes you a good wife?" I said, I just looked at her like I was gonna kill her. She says, "Well, let me tell you something. I can't even say it out loud, I'm gonna say it. But she told me it wasn't lined in gold." And I went, "Oh my God." So I went for her throat. I was gonna kill her. But what happened was I broke that moment, and I couldn't stop crying, and I thought I was gonna die. And all this shit came out. It was like a volcano. And she said, "Now get in that room and get honest." And I did a lot more writing, and I was able to write and talk about the abuse, about being beaten, about being raped, about all the different things, about all the feelings I had, all the moving, being kidnapped and moved into Mexico. My father kidnapped us, and we didn't see my mother for 9 years. And it was just, my life was just really crazy. And I wrote all this stuff out, and I got free. And for the first time in my life, I was purged, and I felt free for the very first time. And she told me I had character traits now: the courage, tenacity, honesty, perseverance, because that's what it takes to work this program, honesty. And we're as honest as we can be in the beginning, and that's why we do it over and over again, because more will be revealed. And so as I did my fifth step, I wrote my list of character defects, pages, lines, columns. It's like this whole table. I thought, "Oh my God, is that what I am? If God removes these, I'm going to vaporize. There's going to be nothing left of me." Fortunately, God does not take them all at once. And unbelievably, for those of you who don't know, some of them he will never take, because they're not really character defects. You're just not using them the right way. And so some of our character defects become our best assets when we switch them around and we do things honestly and with integrity. I had to make a list of the people I had harmed. I was all over that list. But so were the men that harmed me, and I didn't understand that. Why? Why would I put them on my list? I was a child. Why would I want to forgive? Why do I need to make amends to them? She said, "You'll see your part later when we're there." And I thought, my part? What in God's name is my part? My part. I had guilt and shame that was not mine, and I carried it all my life. I had anger, which I was entitled to, and resentment, which I used as a weapon and a shield against other people. I put a wall up around me to protect myself, and what I did was I shut everything out, including God. And I never knew the true meaning of unconditional love, not in my life, even though I thought I did. With a husband who adored me and 5 children, I did not know. Today, I do. I have unconditional love in my life. I finally went to one of the men who was still alive to confront him. And I walked in. He was so sick and fragile and shaking with Parkinson's, and he was very small to me. And I thought, my God, life did to him more than I could have ever dreamed of doing to him. And he's someone I loved, who told me he loved me. And he said, "I thought I'd never see you again." I said, "Yeah, me either." And I just walked up to him. As I got closer, I stopped, and I literally felt I surrendered at that moment. And I felt something like a drain had been pulled out of my foot and something seeped out of my body. And I swear it was like a creepy thing that happens in the movies. I felt something drain out of my body. Physically, I felt it happen. And visually, I saw a fog cross the floor. And it hovered and went into the floor. And I just stood there going, my God, what was that? What was that? And at that moment, I had complete freedom. And I walked over to him and I hugged him. And he said, I love you. And I said, I love you too. And that's the last time I ever saw him. I did not go to his funeral. And he's my best friend's father, my father's best friend. And today, I'm not that little girl. I'm not a victim today. I tell my sponsees, Jesus got off the cross. Here's a hammer. I suggest you take your feet out first. I suggest you take one hand off before you get your feet. Because if you take your feet out first, you're going to hang from your hands. So, but here's your hammer. I have a hammer in my phone, a picture of in my photographs, and I'll send it when they're whining. I send them a picture of a hammer. So here, here's your hammer. Get off the cross. I don't have to volunteer for victimization today. You know, I can be a victim anytime I want. I'm really good at it. I have a PhD in victimization. But today, that's not the way it is. Today, I'm not a victim. I live life. You know, so I did those steps. I made the amends. To the best of my ability, I'm still making amends. I'll tell you, it's so easy to make amends for the things we did in our addiction. But when you do something in recovery that you have to make amends for, that really sucks, bites ass. And making amends is not saying I'm sorry, by the way. Don't say the words I'm sorry. My sponsor said, you were born sorry. Oh man, she cut me no slack at all. Making amends is making right what is wrong. So when I make amends, I have to make right what is wrong. And I've had some situations in my life where I have to talk to someone in, and this is the example she gave me. If you have had an affair, and you better talk to your sponsor before you decide what you want to do with that information, because you do not have the right to go to another human being and tell them what you did and rip their heart out, involve another person, maybe cause a death. But you don't have the right to hurt someone else so you can put your head on a pillow. Sometimes making amends is making right what is wrong, living with what you did, without speaking of it, without getting someone's verbal forgiveness, but learning to forgive yourself by not repeating that behavior and learning that God did forgive you too. And that could be your job. You don't walk into your job and say, well, I embezzled all your money, or, you know, you better maybe talk to a lawyer, or, you know, don't come into a meeting and say you murdered someone. Unless you want it on the 6 o'clock news, it doesn't belong in a meeting. We share in a general way. So there, you can see a priest, you can see a lawyer, you can see your sponsor if you trust them. But there are some things that don't belong in meetings. You know, you don't have the right to destroy your life and your family and leave everyone destitute. You need to get advice. That's why we have sponsors that take us in. It's not, you know, I got clean, let me help you. Go from 1 to 12. I'm clean, I'm going to help you. Usually that leads to 13, and there is no 13. So you want to have some breaks in there. So I did everything I was supposed to do. I do it. We have an IP, living the program, IP number 9. I do that every single day. I just read through it and I answer. I don't write it anymore. I just read it out and I answer it in my head. Do I owe amends? Am I happy? Did I read my literature? Did I go to a meeting? I ask myself those questions every day. Do I make mistakes? Do I still screw up? You bet I do. Do I work a perfect program? Bet I don't. But you know, I like me today. I look in that mirror and I like who I am. I went to college. I found that I was really smart. I couldn't even believe how smart I was. Jesus. I grew up thinking I was stupid. And then while I was trying to do math, because I think I am stupid in math, I'm a mathematical moron, I learned to play the piano again. I learned how to do stained glass, how to oil paint, watercolor, acrylic paint. I'm drumming now. I do drum circles. I learned to do a lot of things. And I thought, I'm creative. Things I didn't know. My dream was to become a scuba diver. And I'm 63 years old, so I usually lie and say I'm only 53, but I'm 63. And 5 years ago, I became a scuba diver, and I have traveled. I've been to Mexico, to Grand Cayman Islands, Cozumel, go back and forth to Cabo, go to Catalina Island off of this coast of California, and I dive. I jumped out of an airplane. Still, 187 miles an hour, free falling before that chute opened, and boy, that hurt right there. But I did it! I did it! You know, so today, I do things. I travel. I am a good wife. I'm a really, really good wife. I'm a really good mother. I'm a really good friend. I'm a really good member of Narcotics Anonymous. I'm a really good human. I'm a productive member of society. I feel pain. I feel your pain. I have compassion. I have tolerance. I practice acceptance. Acceptance doesn't mean I approve of you, by the way. I have people. One of them doesn't like me. One of them doesn't like you. One of them doesn't like my husband. When the one that doesn't like me doesn't like him gets together, it's a little testy, but yeah. My husband comes home and says, "Are your people okay?" I say, "Yeah, except for the one that doesn't like you." He says, "That's okay, I'm better." I'm married to the most incredible man that ever walked the face of the earth. He is my everything. And I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be alive because this is a life that I was willing to give up 26 years ago. I was trying to figure out a way to die without God having my soul. And if I could have figured that out, I would be gone. But I would have shortchanged myself. I would have missed so many heartbeats. I would have missed so many smiles, so many tears, so many opportunities. God puts in front of me the people that he wants me to deal with, and I pray for that every day. Please put in front of me, you know, what you want me to do. Reality is a perfect vision of God's will for me today. You know, it doesn't mean that God wants bad things to happen to me, but life is in session. And this is not easy. This is simple, but this is not easy. Working our program, getting honest, looking at our past, peeling back those onions, looking at reality and not the pretty box in your head. If I put that box that God made right here on the box, on the table, and I go out and find the smelliest, most putrid pile of dog shit, and I put it in that box, and I close it, and the angels give me the ribbons, and I tie it up, everyone walking by will look at that box, and they will kill for that box. They want that box. They'll do anything for the box. They'll pay anything for it. They'll kill anyone for it. But if you come by the box and you stay there long enough next to that box, pretty soon what's inside that box comes out. And you go, "Oh, God," and you're away. You know not to go near that box. But people will come, and when they get close to the box, they'll go, and they know not to get near that box. Pretty soon you just have to go near the door, and you know what's in that box. Because a box of shit is a box of shit, no matter how you package it. I can be that way. If I have nothing but darkness or shit in my heart, then that's all I have. That's all you're going to see. You're not going to see. When you look at someone and you judge someone, you may want to make sure that you're not looking in a mirror first, that you're not seeing yourself in that person. And then if it's truly not, you know, you see people, you just attracted to them. There's just something about them. You just want to be near them. You just want to hug them because they have such a beautiful heart. They have such a beauty inside. And that's what we get here. That light comes on, that fire is lit, and all of that love and all the things that we learn and that we're taught in here, the therapeutic value of one addict helping another, we are promised freedom from active addiction. We are promised hope. And that's what we get. So if you're newer than I am, stick around. Because there are miracles, miracles in this program that you have no idea. And if you're going through hell, don't stop now. Just keep walking. Keep walking. If you put your hand out, someone will take it. I will not get in the gutter with you. You have to get out of the gutter to dance with me. But when you put your hand up, I will pull you up. Because my butterfly net has holes in it. And if I catch you, you're just going to escape. When you're ready, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. So when you're ready. So surrendering is to join the winning side. So if you haven't completely surrendered yet, just remember that we're on your side. We're fighting for you. And we've already been there. And we'll help you walk through hell. You don't have to do anything alone. I've had cancer. I had a brain injury that left me with amnesia. I had to quit my job, what I do for a living. I couldn't speak in sentences for about a year. And today, I feel like a pretty whole person. I'm not. I have scars where you can't see them, but they're healed. And I have everything that I owe is to this program and to the people in it. Every single thing I owe. So thank you for having me. Thank you for welcoming me to your country, to your fellowship, to your meeting. And may the God of your understanding bless you even half as much as mine has blessed me. And if you don't have one, I'll loan him you mine because he's really powerful. I gave him all my power. I'm Ellen. I'm an addict. And enjoy the rest of your weekend.